A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Justice, O royal duke, veil your regard upon a wronged. I would fain have said a maid. O worthy prince, dishonor not your eye by throwing it on any other object till you have heard me in my true complaint and given me justice. Justice! Justice! Justice!
Relate your wrongs. In what? By whom? Be brief. Here is Lord Angelo shall give you justice. Reveal yourself to him.
Oh, worthy Duke, you bid me seek redemption of the devil.
Hello and welcome to The Play's the Thing. My name is Tim McIntosh. This is your podcast for all things Shakespeare. And that was Isabella asking the recently returned Duke for justice. And you heard those last lines when the Duke said, speak to Lord Angelo about your justice. And Isabella said, you bid me seek redemption of the devil. I am joined again by Galen Marie Hurd, who, if you have not listened to the first four episodes, Galen is my wife, and we have been starting every episode of the last four acts, and we're going to start the same way this time with a little parenting corner first. Hey, Galen, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tim. Thank you.
Maybe you could tell the audience where you are and where I am, because we're not both at home.
Mm-hmm. I'm in our living room and dining room and kitchen. I'm in our studio apartment, and you are in a little booth in your co-working space.
And we've been keeping people abreast of our kind of travails, trying to put our beautiful little daughter, Arden, a name taken from Shakespeare's As You Like It. Yeah. We've been kind of talking through the sleeping obstacles that she has presented us as parents. So how did tonight go? We're recording in the evening. You put her down as I kind of came down to the office space. How'd it go, Galen?
I think I hoped that starting a little bit later, she'd be a little more tired and go a little bit faster. And as we talked about on a previous episode, like, hope is dangerous.
Hope is dangerous.
Your hopes can be dashed. And
yes,
my hopes were dashed tonight. She just took the full hour. She likes an hour to go to sleep.
Ugh, of wind down.
Just takes that whole time for her little system to let it go. But it really is about my expectations are the most challenging part.
That's what needs to be calibrated is your expectations.
That's the problem.
I don't know of anybody who's going to say, oh, an hour. If you just dial in an hour
with your baby
to get ready. I don't think anybody's going to say, yeah, it's your problem, Galen, you know, just calibrate for an hour. I don't think anybody's going to say that.
I feel like we should highlight a couple wonderful things, though. She danced with me today for the first time.
Awesome.
Yep. She held my friend's hand while we were on a walk. Like,
yes, that's right.
And, like, took
you
her
told me about that. Yeah.
We walked together. It was, yeah.
Yeah. We're leading with the only feature of our daughter that we're not crazy about. But like everything else, we just, oh my gosh, she's just, we love her. Galen, I just want to remind the audience that we are going to be joined a little bit later by Mary Pat Rogers. I'm going to give Mary Pat's bio when we bring on Mary Pat. We asked her to come on because she did master's work at the University of Dallas on this play, specifically the conclusion of Measure for Measure. I wanted her to come and speak into how she sees the end of the play. Galen, Act 5. Here is my shorthand name for Act 5. Are you ready for it? It's both cheesy and like literary nerd at the same time.
I'm ready.
I call this act Duke Ex Machina. Because the Duke comes on after having been in disguise the first three and a half acts. And he returns and he sets everything straight. So like Deus Ex Machina, the kind of plot device where you just sort of like drop in a character who solves all of the problems in a kind of sometimes a ham-fisted kind of way. That's a little bit how this act goes for me. The Duke comes in. There are all these problems, marriage, life and death issues, marriage issues, legal issues, and the Duke comes in and he solves all of them. Like a god appearing on the stage.
Yeah.
I even wonder if we're supposed to kind of think of him a little bit like a god on the stage. But I think that's another question for another time. Galen, I'm going to ask you to help me do a lot of plot work before we start getting into the questions, because I want to do the plot before we get into whether or not we find these solutions that the Duke presents us to be satisfying. Okay, so beginning of the act, Duke enters the city to much acclaim. The city has been waiting for his return. He brings forward Angelo and Aeschylus. He thanks them. And then we hear Isabella, like from the audio that we heard at the top of the show, crying for justice. She has been wronged by Angelo, the man who has been in the Duke's place. She comes forward. She brings her complaint to the Duke. She calls Angelo a murderer and a hypocrite, an adulterous thief, a virgin violator. And the Duke, who knows everything, he has been behind the scenes watching everything. And I kind of expected, I wonder if you did, that the Duke is going to be like, yep, Angelo, defend yourself.
Yeah, just set it straight right out the gate.
Right. It's not what happens, is it?
No. A little more complex than that. A little more convoluted?
A little more convoluted. He calls Isabella insane. But then he realizes, you know what? She's actually a little bit too logical to be fully insane. So, hey, tell us your story. She tells the whole story about how Claudio was sentenced to death for impregnating his fiance. And then she says that Angelo tried to said, you've got a choice. You can save Claudio, your brother's life, by having sex with me. That's the only way that you're going to get out of, that he's going to get out of this. She refuses at first, but then she cooks up this fanciful solution with this friar. We all know the friar is the Duke, and the friar and Isabella bring Mariana, a long ago jilted fiance of Angelo, and they say, Mariana, Isabella is going to tell Angelo that she'll sleep with him, but instead you go sleep with him. That will save my brother's life. Instead, instead, Angelo is like, you know what? Let's kill Claudio immediately. I got what I wanted. I got to sleep with the woman, but I'm going to kill Claudio anyway, and I'm going to kill him more quickly. So that's the cry of justice from Isabella. Isabella is dismissed by the Duke. He orders her off to prison, and then we meet Mariana again. She is veiled. She's a witness. The Duke and her have a little word play. I don't know. Fencing match. She says, are you married? No. Are you a maid or a widow? Mm. No. And the Duke is like, well, come on. What are you? And Mariana says, well, I've slept with my husband, but he doesn't know it. So therefore I'm not a maid and we're not married. So therefore I'm not a wife either. Mm-hmm. So that's a fun little bit of wordplay. Mm-hmm. This whole time, we know the answer to the problems. We just are waiting for the Duke to kind of reveal all. And it doesn't happen until the Duke says, you know what? I've got to speak to this friar that everybody keeps referring to. Mm-hmm. The Duke steps off and then he comes back on hooded as this friar. And the kind of climactic moment is the friar having his hood taken off by Lucio after he and Lucio kind of like argue a little bit. Yeah. It's a lovely moment of revelation.
And we all see it coming.
We all see it coming. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mounting. We know the reveal is coming. It's just like, how long do we have to wait for it to happen?
And it's a lovely bit of theater. In fact, let's hear the audio behind this, Galen. This is Lucio and the Duke hooded as the friar going back and forth. You're going to hear Lucio call the Duke friar a bald-pated lying rascal.
Fosa! Why, you bald-pated lying rascal! Oh, you must be hooded, must you? Show your knave's visage with a pox to show your sheep-biting face and be hanged an hour. Wilt not off! Thou art the first knave that e'er madest a duke.
That was Lucio arguing with the Duke, and the Duke, after having pulled back his friar's hood and revealed himself as being the Duke, saying, thou, Lucio, art the first knave that ever madest a duke. So now everything is going to be made clear and right. But not before Isabella is asked by Mariana to kneel before the Duke and to ask for forgiveness for Angelo. And this is while Isabella still believes that Angelo has killed her brother. It hasn't been revealed that her brother is still alive. That's going to happen a little bit later. And Isabella does it. She kneels with Mariana and she says, listen, when he started, he had good intentions. I think you should give him grace for that. And so it's a remarkable bit of forgiveness. I said at home to you, this really feels like a Christ-like moment. Like, we ask that you forgive the person who has done us the most wrong. It's a beautiful moment. And now we move on to the Duke making all these marriages. And the surprise one, you called it, Galen Marie. You called it, didn't you? At the end of the last show, I said, like, what are we going to be looking for in Act 5? And you said it.
Yeah, Isabella and the Duke. Like, why not? These two noble characters who have been in cahoots, like, he's been helping her out behind the scenes. He's gotten to know her. Why not?
Why not? Mm-hmm. So this is maybe the big question. Like, why not? Does it work for the play? Does it make sense of these characters? Mm-hmm. And I have asked a special guest to come on and join us. Let me give you her bio before I welcome her to the show. Mary Pat Rogers gratefully received her master's degree from the University of Dallas, and she's been teaching rhetoric, Latin, British literature, especially Shakespeare, in classical schools for the last 10 years. Mary Pat, welcome to the show. We're delighted to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tim. I'm delighted to be here.
What a joy. Mary Pat, you've got kids too.
I do. I have two kids. our kids actually share a name. So our daughter,
they do.
Yeah. Our daughter, is named Juliana Arden.
Oh, beautiful.
Isn't that great?
That is awesome.
That is great. That is great. And she, I assume, is also named after the Forest of Arden and As You Like It. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Directly from Shakespeare. Yeah.
Yeah. We're officially in like Shakespeare nerd land. This is so great. This makes me so happy. Mary Pat, I want to ask you a question about your master's work. And I want to ask you, what was the question in your master's thesis that you were trying to answer about Measure for Measure? And then I want to ask you in a second how your thesis answered it. But first, what would you say the question was that you were trying to answer?
I think ultimately what the work was trying to answer was whether or not Shakespeare cares about his characters, right? Like, does he sacrifice Isabella specifically at the end of Measure for Measure? And that was really where the thesis was trying to go.
Yeah. To catch our audience up, I want to play the very last monologue by the Duke. Everything has been set straight. Angelo is now engaged to Mariana. Claudio is now engaged to Juliet. Lucio is engaged as kind of a punishment to this punk, this prostitute that he kind of was bragging about sleeping with, Kate Keepdown, subtle name. And the very end, there's a proposal, it sure sounds like, from the Duke to Isabel. Let's listen to the audio. This is the very closing lines of the play.
She, Claudio, that you wronged, look you restore. Joy to you, Mariana. Love her, Angelo. I have confessed her, and I know her virtue. Thanks, good friend Aeschylus, for thy much goodness. There's more behind that is more gratulate. Thanks, Provost, for thy care and secrecy. We shall employ thee in a worthier place. Forgive him, Angelo, that brought you home the head of Ragazine for Claudio's. The offense pardons itself. Dear Isabel, I have a motion much imports your good. Whereto, if you're a willing ear incline, what's mine is yours, and what is yours is mine. So, bring us to our palace, where we'll show what's yet behind that's meet. You all should know.
That was the Duke speaking to Isabel. Dear Isabel, I have a motion much imports your good. Whereto, if you'll a willing ear incline, what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine. So bring us to our palace where we'll show what's yet behind that's meet you all should know. That's the text. Nothing more in there from Shakespeare's hand other than an exit. So, Mary Pat, you told us what the question was that your thesis was trying to answer. Can you tell us what the thesis ended up arguing?
Well, originally, the thesis ended up arguing that Shakespeare at least attempts to save Isabella. Particularly from the Duke, and that he's doing so using something that I was calling a rhetorical silence. Two silent moments specifically that are acting rhetorically rather than just as a void. And that both of those silences can be read textually as not only a refusal to marry him, but a re-entrance into the life as a poor Claire, as one of the nuns of St. Clair.
Can you tell us where those silences fall?
Sure. Yeah. So we have one of them that we heard in the audio that was just played. So the second one occurs right after he says, "Where to, if you'll a willing ear incline."
Mm.
What's mine is yours, and what's yours is mine. That line actually ends in a poetic caesura. And so there's a space there for her to interject if she wanted to or was allowed to, or, you know, however you kind of want to think
right.
about it. So there's one. And then the other one is right after the first marriage proposal that he gives. And he actually asks her to speak there. Second time he asks her to listen. So the first time he says, give me your hand and say you will be mine. He is my brother too. And then there's this mistake in the middle of the line where there's a pause. I mean, there's a hard stop there in the middle of the line. And then he says, but fitter time for that. It's almost like depending on how long that that pause is, that can be a really awkward moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I just have to interject here. No, go ahead, Galen. Go ahead, Galen. Well,
but fitter time for that. It sounds like after the second pause, there's... Okay, but we'll talk about this in the castle. Like, let's go on. So he's kind of like moving it along after an awkward silence both times.
Both times, yes. Yeah. He doesn't... He does either fill the void because he was expecting there to be a void, or he... fills it because now there is one and he doesn't.
He wasn't expecting it.
Yeah.
When we were watching, we watched the old BBC version from the mid-80s. And Galen, I wonder if you remember this. When the Duke says those last lines, the camera holds her in frame with the Duke. And there is a long pause. Right. And then he's holding his hand out the whole time. And it's probably, what do you think, Galen? A 5-second pause, which in screen time, it's a long time. Right. And then she puts her hand in his
and
they
cheers.
Hand in hand. Yeah. Everyone cheers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't say anything to Galen because Galen is just taking this act by act by act.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a little bit about what you argued, Mary Pat, and I just wanted to be like, did Galen pick up on anything here? Namely, that the text does not have any stage directions right there.
Yeah. No, I totally didn't.
Because you kind of, in a way, you really, and I think this is part of being a good movie viewer, playgoer, you kind of entrust yourself to the director and the actors when you're watching it.
Yeah, I assumed they were interpreting it.
Yeah, it's a total safe assumption. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But right, okay. So Mary Pat, you make this argument that these silences are there. And do you argue that you think that Isabella takes the silences deliberately? Or are you just saying this is something for the director? This is an option for directors. They need to decide this question.
Yeah, so that ended up being what the problem ultimately was. Is it something that Isabella is running with, or is it just a artistic choice that someone can make? So initially, I wanted to argue that it was Isabella willfully choosing not to respond.
Yeah.
Also choosing not to give a flat out refusal, a verbal refusal to the Duke. She doesn't want to embarrass him, hopefully, right? She has completed the task that was set before her. So when she says that she's in Act One, when she says she's going to ask the mother for leave, that's kind of the plan. She's going to go save her brother. And then the idea is that she will return. Mm-hmm. And once her brother is safe, she doesn't really say anything else. And the thing that I found, I think, the most fascinating was that silence is one of the vows that a poor Claire would have made.
Right. Yes. Right.
And so it works for Isabella to remain silent mm-hmm. as a move, actually, mm-hmm. instead of saying no or whatever, you know, saying yes. But that ultimately, by the time the thesis was finished and approved, I think the argument had to be that it's possible to read it multiple ways.
And do you stand by that, or did you feel like your thesis advisor kind of needed you to I don't know, like have some wiggle room?
Yeah. I think at the time I really did not agree with the advisor's recommendations. Actually I had two different advisors, and so it cleared advisor one and did not clear advisor two.
Oh, wow.
That made it even more convoluted as to who am I listening to? You know, who do I, but it's been several years now since that thesis was finished. And so, I have a lot more respect for the idea that it could go either way.
Mm.
I've heard some arguments that are very, very specific about, you know, picking out one line in act three or something that saying, you know, like, well, it has to be this way because of this line.
So
I understand that there is a lot of wiggle room there. And the main argument is that if Isabella doesn't marry the Duke, it throws the comic structure a huge loop.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas everyone else is marrying, you know, but even in my discussions with my advisor, I was saying, but she is getting married.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The church, you know, she's herself to God, to the divine. And so there's still a marriage that's happening. It's just not the same mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that didn't get very far.
It didn't get very far, really.
No, it didn't get very far. I think that there is something to be said for wondering if Shakespeare is trying to maintain a form. Is he trying to make structure, or does he not care about the structure at this point in his career? And that is not something that the thesis set out to answer. And it's not something I necessarily have an answer for. But
could you, in your thesis, I'm just so curious about this question, and I find myself in great sympathy to what you're arguing. Could you, in your thesis, argue beyond the fence of Measure for Measure and go into other plays and say, look, it sure looks like in The Tempest he was messing with form, and it sure looks like in The Winter's Tale he was messing with form?
Absolutely.
Were you able to do that? Yeah.
Yeah, in my thesis, I did not go beyond Measure for Measure. Space to really do that. But I think you could absolutely make that argument, right? That he is, especially later in Shakespeare's career.
Right.
Absolutely trying to play with the forms and see what they can support and what they can't support.
Right.
And I could be totally wrong about this, but I think that this play was one of the first ones played for James
I. Oh, in my mental timeline, without looking at it, that makes sense. I think that's right.
I could be remembering wrong, but I think that that's correct. And that there's something, I mean, Shakespeare really has done all of the tragedy, comedy, history. He has done it all. And so it's time to have a little bit of fun.
That'd be another vote in your favor. Like, I mean, he's surely as wildly experimental as he was with language and with like customs, surely he took liberty with comedic forms.
And also
for me, I mean, Galen and I talked about this on and off the air. Her vow, she was taking a vow of silence. And she was never going to speak to a man again, if I'm not mistaken. That gets mentioned in the play.
Yeah.
That just seems like a real closing of the circle if she is silent before the Duke's offer.
Yes, and I believe that she is. The last time that she speaks is when she's pleading for Angelo's life.
Hmm.
And she ends up being successful.
Yeah.
At plea.
Her work is done.
Is done.
Yeah.
And she, the really fascinating thing is for me, I guess, I'm like Shakespeare nerd, but beyond Shakespeare himself, Shakespeare probably ran into some poor Clares. Where he was living, they wouldn't have been in a cloister.
Convent.
Uh-huh. They would have been dissolved, right, by Henry. There were some still living in the area, and they know that Shakespeare saw their rule of life. It's quoted in the play. And the rule of life is called Isabella's rule.
What? No way.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild.
Wow.
So the naming of her, the way that, like what you're talking about not being able to talk to a man, that is part of the rule. I just have a hard time moving Isabella into a position where she's going to marry a man.
Right. Right. Okay, let me throw it back to Galen. Galen, I'm going to ask you to try to ignore or bracket everything that Mary Pat said, which I realize is going to be really hard.
Yeah.
could you imagine when we finished watching the play the other night, could you imagine Isabella being happy with the Duke?
So, to me, it makes me think of The Sound of Music. I'm like, there's some part of me that thinks, but if the right man comes along who is just enough and good enough and has enough like greatness in him, but also he's righteous, like maybe it could work. What I don't like the idea of is that he's like, you, I'll have you. And she's like, okay. If that didn't sort of organically happen, then it's much less satisfying to me. I guess we'd have to believe that she has somehow fallen for him in the 5 seconds that she realizes that the friar is also him. And that's just a lot to ask.
Yeah.
So I certainly predicted and could see him falling for her. I can believe that she could fall for him, but not quite the way that it played out.
Yeah.
So,
right.
So I'm going to unbracket now. I love Mary Pat's addition here.
It's this really compelling.
Exciting to me.
I was already super sympathetic, but the fact that it was called Isabella's Rule.
Yeah.
And Shakespeare would have been in contact, I mean, just had some sort of contact with women who had taken on this rule. That just seems.
Yeah.
That's a heavy evidential stack in favor of Mary Pat's thesis for me.
I have a question. Is it possible that, like, so it sounds like there's one interpretation where she refuses with her silence, and there's an interpretation where she accepts with her silence. Like, that's the BBC version we saw. Is there some other, like open to, like, we are left wondering, the audience really doesn't get to know at the end of the play?
So, Tim, you're probably more able to answer that question, but I know there have been versions of it played where everyone else is exiting in pairs. The Duke exits alone. Huh. And Isabella is looking, she looks towards him as he's exiting, and then she looks toward the opposite side of the stage. And then she looks, I can't remember if it's like she looks back at him or she looks at the audience, and everything goes dark.
That's, oh, yes. Yeah. I like that.
The clue.
Yep.
So the first time that I saw Measure for Measure, it was at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And the Oregon Shakespeare Festival was great at taking liberties. They gave their directors a lot of liberty, and the directors would take that liberty. Sometimes they kind of went a little bit too far, but oftentimes they would have really imaginative scene work. And they ended, in short, Mary Pat, if you saw the conclusion of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival's production that I saw, you, I think, would have been thrilled. Because she does not go off hand in hand with him. And the way that they stage it is, if I recall correctly, she clearly feels something for the Duke, but whether or not she feels enough for the Duke to go back on her original vow, that is the conundrum that the play ends in. And I think it was beautiful because you do have these other couples that are going off toward marriages. We're especially happy for Claudio and for Juliet. Oh my gosh, they're going to get to be together after this potential terrible injustice being done. But then we kind of see a little bit off to the side, Isabella and the Duke kind of with a lot of space in between them, and the play, just the director does not resolve the question. And I loved it because we still get the kind of closing of the comedic loop that comedies end in marriages. That is the form. So we get that, but we also see that there is one couple that's not quite there. And it, for me, it worked. It drew my attention to Isabella, and it really, really worked. I'm going to talk about one other play that they did. Mary Pat, Much Ado About Nothing. Have you paid attention to it? Have you read it recently?
Not read it recently, but yeah, okay. So that's okay.
Hero is falsely accused, I can't remember his name, of cheating, and he breaks the engagement. And then they're reunited at the end, but Hero has been shamed in front of everyone, in front of her father, all of her friends, her waiting ladies, everyone. And then when Benedict and Beatrice get together, Hero and the character I can't remember also are presumed to get together and go be married. But it's a really hard thing to accept that Hero, who just an hour earlier was humiliated in front of everybody, is like, oh, great, I get to marry this guy who just made me look like trash in front of everybody. The Oregon Shakespeare Festival basically had her saying, nope, I'm not going to do it. And she walks out to a corner of the stage and she stands there and she doesn't go in with the kind of marriage procession. And so that's the kind of solutions that the Oregon Shakespeare Festival would put forward. They're the same people that put that measure for measure, plot solution forward. I just found it really satisfying in both instances. Okay, let's ask a question about, and let's assume for the sake of the conversation that all of the proposed marriages happen, even Isabella and the Duke. What do we think about these marriages going forward after the play ends? Who are we optimistic about? Who are we pessimistic about? Galen?
Well, Claudio and Juliet, that's the obvious one.
Right.
Great. Happily ever after.
Right. Okay, that's a wrap.
I'm feeling good about Angelo and Mariana.
You are.
She clearly loves him to the ends of the earth. So they've got that going for them. I want to think Angelo has, you know, he's been publicly shamed.
Mm.
He's sort of privately had a breaking moment. He's done things he should not have done. He knows he should not have done them. And no real consequences occurred. Like, nobody was really hurt by all the terrible things that he did. So he should have a new lease on life, and he should be grateful for this opportunity to be with a woman who loves him and move forward as a humbled man. That's what I'm hoping for Angelo.
Yeah. I mean, in this scene, he's asking for death.
Yeah.
He's like, I'll just go ahead and like take my head off. I know what I've done. I've done wrong. Mary Pat, are you somewhat optimistic?
I want to be optimistic, particularly for Angelo and Mariana. But man, I'm so sorry. I'm going to riff off of Parents Corner because it or dash sometimes, right? And I want to believe that Angelo is a changed man, but that is also, speaking of hard shifts, it's a hard shift to go from begging for death to being happy in marriage.
Mm.
And that's a turn.
Yeah.
So I want to believe that they're going to be just fine, but I think they have some work to do.
Yeah.
They're going to be fine. Yeah.
Galen is a professional therapist, and that might be like the challenge of your professional career, Galen.
Getting those two.
Helping them make it. Yeah. Although I actually will say, let's go to Lucio and Kate Keepdown. That might be the bigger challenge, actually. Is anyone feeling optimistic? Can anybody make a case that that marriage has got a really good shot?
I feel like I'm the eternal optimist here.
I love it, Galen. Go for it. I love it.
Please do. Go.
All right. Lucio is just, he's a playboy. He's just been frittering away his life. And Kate Keepdown, she's probably pretty cool. She's...
Why not? Yeah.
I think sometimes when people who are way too loosey-goosey and open and their lives are unstructured, when there's structure imposed on them, sometimes they respond well. Sometimes it goes well. And maybe they can be, I don't know, kind of playful together.
Yeah.
I'm stretching a little bit there, but
sure.
That's my.
But that would be great. If they would just piece it together.
Yeah. Just make it work. I think this is the beauty of the comic ending, right? It's like everyone gets married. We can just kind of tie it all up with a bow and be like, maybe it's all going to work out. Maybe everything's going to be good.
Oh man, the eternal pessimist. I don't see them working out. Like in a typical understanding of marriage. There seems to be very little guardrail to keep them in their respective lane.
Lucio is so, I love him at the beginning of the play. I think he's hilarious. He's on the right side of justice. You know, he's recruiting Isabella. He's buddies with Claudio. And by the end, I'm just like, dude, have you not learned yet? Like, know the score before you start running your mouth. Yeah. You keep running your mouth and it keeps like, what's the old saying? Your mouth is writing checks that your bank can't pay. That's Lucio. He kept running his mouth and finally he gets unmasked as soon as when the Duke throws back his hood. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
In the beginning, he's like really pushing Isabella to make her argue to Angelo. And without that, it seems like she would have just slunk back and not saved her brother's life. So he's important in that part.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. He's very important. But it just goes all downhill. Yeah. Goes all downhill from there. Okay. It sounds like...
Like when he goes downhill. Like what's the point in the play where the turn... That would be interesting to see.
If I recall it, the moment that I remember him turning south is when he is having that private conversation with the Friar Duke. Mm-hmm. After the Friar Duke is in prison, kind of beginning to work his magic, mm-hmm. and he kind of bumps into Lucio and they have that comedic moment. But is there something that leads that moment that maybe makes Lucio turn a little sour?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
They
look back.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't recall, and I don't remember when watching the play thinking like, oh, now Lucio is going to be the branded pessimist who can't stop running his mouth. Anyway.
I mean, the only thing that I could maybe see is that, I mean, he's really fighting for Claudio to be saved.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, everyone's like, it's not going to happen. There's no hope.
Yeah, he gives up hope. Yeah.
And Angelo is now there's this reign of terror and everyone just has to sort of accept it. And maybe Lucio's way of dealing with that is just to get silly, just to like,
yeah,
nothing matters, make it super light, be playful.
I can imagine that. I can see that. Mary Pat, we're going to start closing up shop. I'm going to ask you, where does Measure for Measure rank for you? Is this like one of your favorites? Is it middle of the pack? What do you think about it overall as a piece of theater work by William Shakespeare?
I love this play. It's definitely top three for me.
Really? Really?
I don't love teaching it, though. Mm. And I think it's because I love the play. You don't ever have time in a classroom to kind of like get all of the nuance and you can't throw a complex comedy at young students.
Yeah.
That's not what they need.
Right.
So, yeah, I love the play. I would love to... I've seen a couple of performances of it. I'd love to see more, but yeah.
Does the play, for me, the first three acts are like incandescently good. They're so rhetorically powerful. I struggle with acts four and act five. It seems like Shakespeare kind of like bolted on a murder mystery or something like that, the last two acts bother you at all?
They do. Well, so I notice them more because they are more upsetting for sure.
Yeah.
Part of the reason, and you're right, the first three acts are rhetorical genius is happening on stage. But, and of course, Isabella is a big part of that. She's not the only part, but she is a big part of that.
And
things start unraveling for Angelo, who's kind of our other rhetorical genius, that you kind of start sensing like everybody's losing a grip going on. And this is part of what, part of the question of the thesis was, you know, does Shakespeare sacrifice his heroine? If he does, that sacrifice is very slow. Her line count diminishes over the course of the play, so that almost all of her lines are in the first three acts. We hear very little from her in the last two acts. And so there's this move away from Isabella, almost a removal of autonomy. She's not of managing her affairs anymore. And so I think that that lends to that shift in feeling, how we feel about the different acts. Because if she sparkled all the way through, it wouldn't be the same play.
Yeah. So why not have her sparkle the whole way through? Why not? Because it becomes the Duke's play. The last two acts, it becomes the Duke's play.
Which is a shame.
And right, because it diminishes the play. Totally.
Yeah. I wonder, I think that's kind of where getting more into the history of it and, you know, if it's the first play that James the First sees and that
he's the Duke coming into the city.
Duke coming in, yeah. You can imagine that Shakespeare wouldn't necessarily have a lot of leeway.
Yeah.
Isabella sparkled the whole time, right? The Duke has to rule and reign at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, that insight kind of helps absolve a little bit the kind of problems of the last two acts for me. It doesn't make the play any better for those last two acts, but I think it's a little bit of an understanding about why Shakespeare, his hand might have been forced. Yeah.
Can we just ask what the Duke was up to this whole time?
Yeah, what was the Duke up to?
I would like to hear from
Mary Pat.
That is the question, right? What is doing? I don't know. Because at the end, his last two lines bring us to our palace where we'll show what's yet behind. That's meat you all should know. Like there is something else happening. Like totally behind the scenes. No one has any clue what's going on. What is it?
Yeah.
Or is he just calling everybody's bluff? I don't know.
And there's probably...
I'll tell you what's going on.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's go.
But after the play ends.
Yeah. When no one else, when the audience...
Come back here. Let's let the curtain fall. I'll let you guys know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there's enough textual evidence to make a real rigorous case that like the secret plan was X. Mm-hmm. Like I couldn't pick it out.
Mm-hmm. The mystery is part of the play.
He certainly doesn't, even if his whole point is to out Angelo.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that the Duke could have pinpointed that Angelo was going to go for Claudio. Isabella was going to step in for Claudio. Right? There are so many moving parts in all of the choices that Angelo could have made that he didn't make.
Yeah.
I think the Duke is just flying by the seat of his pants.
Probably so. At the end of the day, it sure seems that way. Galen, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I have more thoughts, but I know we need to wrap it up.
I want to hear this thought.
One last thought. Okay. When the Duke in the, when Isabella accuses the Angelo and the Duke doesn't immediately clear it up, it seems like that is giving Angelo one last chance to be honest. Or to incriminate himself, to like say, that lady's crazy, she needs to be locked up. And then his fall is even worse because he has said publicly, like she's called him out and he has said publicly, nope, it's on her. So he gets another chance to be like, to do another terrible thing. And to me, this whole play is about Angelo. It's the fall of Angelo. And his ultimate, like, possible redemption, or at least the grace given to him by Isabella. And the most powerful moments to me, although Claudio's, you know, monologue is very powerful, the most powerful moments to me have been watching Angelo crumble and make these decisions, like going downhill. And then his redemption at the end, or his forgiveness at the end, is just so powerful. It seems like all these machinations could be just to create this arc for him, somehow. That was just my own
plausible to you, Mary Pat, that this was all about, like, it's like a test is what you're saying, Galen. It's a test. The Duke is testing Angelo.
It seems like it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, he wants to know what Angelo is made of. I think he has some knowledge. He knows some of it, but he doesn't know how far down it goes into Angelo.
Yeah.
And I guess the question that I still have, though, is why? Okay, so like, so if Angelo is the second in command, is it all just a training ground for later? Is this right,
with human lives at stake?
Is this Angelo's training ground? Yes, someone could have been beheaded. Someone was, actually.
Yeah.
But we don't really know him, so it's fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, it strikes me that there's a kind of metaphor here in the way, like, human life goes, that there's temptations, there's all kinds of opportunities to make terrible decisions. And there's something kind of beautiful but surprising about the grace given to him at the end, despite all the mistakes he's made, by this Christ-like figure, Isabella. Yeah. But yeah, why? Within the context of the play, not as a metaphor, but just in the reality of it, why would the Duke go to all this trouble? It seems like it's for Angelo, as opposed to, like, because if he really thought highly of Angelo and wanted to test him, it seems like his prior knowledge of the fact that Angelo's kind of been a jerk to Mariana plays against that, that he doesn't really believe in Angelo. And he kind of maybe knows he's going to fall, or at least thinks it's possible. Yeah. So it's another mystery. There are just a lot of mysteries here.
And the pace of the drama keeps moving forward so swiftly that you kind of don't ask it in the middle of it. Like, we're letting these acts breathe, and we're taking time between each act to discuss them. But when you just watch it straight through, the forward momentum kind of blocks your ears a little bit against asking this big question, which is a really significant question. Like, Duke, what are you doing? Why are you doing this?
So you both love this play. And are the mysteries part of what you love about it? The unanswered questions.
For me, the Isabella silence is a huge part of my attraction to the play.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. The Duke thing, the Duke's bizarre reasoning, rationale for setting all these things in motion, I actually think it's a weakness.
Mm.
What do you think, Mary Pat? Are the mysteries appealing to you?
I would second what you said, Tim. The way that the Duke maneuvers, and the kind of the open-endedness of some of that is, I think it could have been cleaner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's terrible to say about Shakespeare. You could have fixed it, man. but yeah, Isabella, I just fell in love with Isabella.
No doubt.
And had a very clear desire to see her instated, even from Act One, even from the time that she leaves the cloister, had a desire to see her succeed and return. So that's all, I mean, that was already coloring my reading, I know. So to me, the rest of it is just a side story, kind of.
Yeah, filler.
Yeah,
it's all Isabella.
Yeah. Cool. Hey, I want to thank you both for coming on the show. This has been a great joy. You heard in my bio of Mary Pat that she's been teaching at a classical school for the last 10 years. This show is platformed by the Searcy Institute, which is at the vanguard of the Christian classical renewal. I encourage you to go look at their website, searcyinstitute.com. That's C-I-R-C-E. Our next play, King John, will complete all of the works of Shakespeare on this podcast. It's a kind of momentous, I don't know, recording for me. And I have asked some of the original kind of members of the podcast, David Kern, Heidi White, and Sean Johnson, to join me for King John. And I think we're even going to have some recorded memories from some of our guests in previous episodes. So I encourage you to listen to King John. It will be coming out in about 1 week. Meanwhile, Mary Pat, thank you so much for joining us. It was illuminating and really fun to have you on.
Thanks so much, Tim. It was a pleasure of mine.
Galen Marie, thanks for being on the podcast.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. And listen, I'll see you at home in just a little bit.
All right. Sounds good.
Hey, guys. Show's not over. I'm at home, and I walked in the door, and Galen said, "I think I know what the play's about." And I insisted that we, like, record it. Galen, what's the play about?
Well, it sort of like dawned on me that this is my interpretation as we were talking with Mary Pat. And I just could not just say it. I was like, this feels too bold. And what do I know? And now you're making
me. When you said it to me, I was like, that's a great interpretation.
Well, now you're making me say it to everybody. So, like I said, I really think, to me, this play is about Angelo. It's about the fall of Angelo. And that it's possible that all this has been constructed to sort of give him an opportunity to, he's being tested, right? We kind of said that. And what's hard to buy in the context that it's in is that we don't think he's worthy of this opportunity. He doesn't, it seems like the Duke already knows he's not worthy of this opportunity. And it just struck me that this is a metaphor potentially for human life, for mm-hmm. what God gives us. Mm-hmm. And that if the Duke is in the role of God saying, hey, I know you're not perfect, but here's your opportunity, here's your freedom. Mm-hmm. Here's the playground, and you can make mistakes. And he does. He sins, and then he sins to cover up the sin, and then he lies about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just goes all the way. And if Isabella is the Christ-like character, she comes in and pleads for him to be forgiven and for the slate to be washed clean. Mm-hmm. And all he has to do is get married, like, be in love.
Yeah.
And he gets to walk out free. And it's really quite beautiful because you watch him tortured in the midst of his sin. You know, he says, I wish I had not. And really everything is, well, I guess, like I said earlier, like all, he wishes he had not killed Claudio. Turns out he hadn't really killed Claudio. There's this total absolution mm-hmm. for him. And it's just this incredible grace, and he's not worthy of it.
Right. Mary Pat and I said at the end of the show, first three acts are about Isabella, last two acts are about the Duke. But to your point, the whole play is about Angelo. Angelo is forcing all of the action. Mm-hmm. And so if we think of him as sort of like, yeah, he's really kind of our protagonist. He's our main character. He's the one that we're watching to see if anything changes. Mm. It kind of unlocks the play. It's a very typological Christian interpretation of the play. And I think it works very neatly.
It also makes it this interesting interpretation of the Duke saying, what's yours is mine and what's mine is yours.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
To Isabella. Because
right.
that marriage is already true. If
yes, absolutely.
You know, we take them as the metaphor,
as representatives. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
This is. I really like this.
It's fun. It's fun.
And it works really well.
It kind of does. But, you know, I still feel like, what do I know? But this is the beauty of Shakespeare, that there's a lot of richness there. So you get to play with it like this. So thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Galen. It's late. Let's go to bed.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.